Lockdown, in red, over and over again like it was a mantra. The counter in front of him glowed with the name Chief Petty Officer Narwa. Okay, Bobby said. She'd waited in line for nearly 2 hours to get up to the window, and she certainly hadn't done it to be told things she already knew. Behind her, the press of bodies was enough to give the office a little extra warmth, the air a little too much closeness. I understand that, but I have questions. I feel like I've told you everything you need to know, Narwa said. Look, Chief, Bobby said, I just need to get a few clarifying details and I'm out of your hair. Narwa gave her a delicate shrug of his shoulders. If there had been any spin gravity, he'd have leaned on the counter. He looked like a guy who ran a noodle shop in Innes Shallows. She wondered if they were related. I own that ship, Bobby continued. Is this a permanent impound? Are you commandeering it? Will I be paid any compensation for the loss of the ship? Will I or my crew be allowed on board to get our personal effects if the ship is being confiscated? A few points, Narwa said. Just those, Bobby agreed. For now. Narwa pulled something up on the counter and flicked it over to her. She felt her hand terminal buzz in her pocket. This is the form you can fill out to file for return of property or compensation for the loss of the ship. We are not thieves. The Navy will provide one or the other. What about our stuff? Bobby asked, while the naval wheels of justice slowly turn. This form, Narwa said, and her terminal buzzed again, is to get an escorted pass onto the ship to get your personal items off it. They're usually processed within 48 hours, so you shouldn't have to wait long. Well, thank, Bobby started, but Narwa was already looking at the person behind her in line and yelling, Next! Any word from Holden and Naomi yet? Alex asked. Not yet, Amos said, tapping his hand terminal with a thumb. System's pretty loaded up right now, though. Maybe getting stuck in queue. They have it in lockdown, she said. There's not going to be free comms on Medina that aren't getting scanned by their systems. Sounds like that could add some time to delivery, Amos said. Standard occupation protocols care a lot more about security than convenience, Bobby said. Message tracking, air-gapped encryption, pattern-based censorship, human review censorship, throttled traffic, you name it. It fit with everything else that was suddenly changed and beyond her control. She couldn't have her ship. She couldn't get her people back together. She had to ask permission and an escort to let her retrieve her own clothes. So of course their messages were getting stuck in Medina's system. They'd found a bar on the inner face of the drum. The long ramp from the transfer point at the center of Spin had been thick with carts and people on foot, some heading up toward the docks, and many like them coming back down. The grim expressions had been the same both ways. I was captain for about a week, Bobby said, the beer in her cup sloshing dangerously as she jabbed the air with it. I mean, depending on if you count from when Holden offered it to me. Or when we did the paperwork. The paperwork came later, so officially, I guess. Houston clocked as much time in control of the Rocinante as I did. You're drunk, Alex said, gently pushing her beer hand back down to the table. He was sitting next to her at a long faux wood table. Amos and Clarissa sat across the table from them. Amos had a beer in his hand and half a dozen empties on the table and didn't appear impaired in the slightest. Clarissa had a plate of cold, soggy French fries in front of her and was using them to push ketchup into spiral art. I'm a little drunk, Bobby agreed. I was just starting to like the idea of being captain of my own ship and these Laconian assholes took it away. She punctuated the word Laconian by jabbing her glass toward one of their marines walking past the bar. Beer splashed across the table and into Clarissa's fries. She didn't seem to notice or care. Bobby plucked up her napkin and dabbed the worst of it away, anyhow, with only a little pang of guilt. "And that's why you need to ease down on the bruise, sailor," Alex said, just taking the glass away from her now. "We need to skip past this grief stage and get on to the kicking ass and getting our shit back stage." "You got a plan?" Amos asked. His tone said he found this dubious. "Not yet, but that's what we need to be doing," Alex shot back. "'Cause a couple hundred Marines, one destroyer in the docks, and one whatever the fuck that flying violation of the laws of physics is," Amos said, pausing to sip his beer and smack his lips. "That's gonna be one hell of a plan. I gotta get in on that action." "Hey, asshole," Alex said, half standing up from his chair. "At least I want to do something more than feel sorry for myself." "This here?" Amos said. He pointed to the Marine outside, the security drones that now hovered over every part of Medina's drum, the people in Laconian Navy uniforms everywhere. "I've seen this before. This is us getting paved over. All we can do now is try to find some cracks to grow through." "Cracks?" Alex said, then sat back down with a thump. "How long I known you? Half the time I still got no idea what the fuck you're talking about." "No one is doing anything," Bobby said. "Not till I give the order. We get this pass to get our stuff off the Rossi. Maybe we can start making a strategy from there. I may not have a ship, but I can sure as hell still have my crew." "Be nice to sneak a gun or two off the ship," Amos agreed. "Be nicer to find a way to get Betsy off," Alex said to her, "if that's possible." "So, until then, we wait," Bobby said, then started pressing on the table, trying to order another beer. "I just wish I understood what this Duarte asshole wants." "They haven't started killing people," Amos said. "I mean, it's still early days. Lots of room for shit to go pear-shaped." "But why now?" Bobby waved her arms around at the bar, at Medina, at all of human space beyond them. "We were just starting to figure this shit out. Earth and Mars working together, the colonies talking out their problems. Even the transport union turned out to be a pretty good idea. Why come kick the table over? Couldn't he have just pulled up a chair with the rest of us?" "Because some men need to own everything." The voice was so quiet it took Bobby a moment to realize Clarissa had spoken. She was still making ketchup art with her French fries and not looking at any of them.
"What's that, Peaches?" Amos said.
"Some men," Clarissa replied, louder and looking up at them now, "need to own everything."
"Hell, I met this Duarte guy," Alex said. "I don't remember him being..."
"This sounds like personal experience," Bobby said, cutting him off. "What are you thinking, Claire?" "When I was a little girl, I remember my father deciding to buy up a majority share in the largest rice producer on Ganymede. Rice is a necessity crop, not a cash crop. You'll always sell everything you can grow, but the prices aren't high because it's easier to grow than a lot of other things. And at that time, his companies had an annual revenue in excess of $1 trillion. I remember an advisor telling my father that the profits from owning rice domes on Ganymede would add a 1 with 5 zeros in front of it percent to that."
"Not sure I..."
Alex started, but Clarissa ignored him, so he trailed off. "But the largest food producers were the rice growers. They had the biggest domes and farms, the most real estate. By owning and controlling a share in their company, my father was in a position to dictate policy to the Ganymede Agricultural Union. It meant, in terms of Ganymede food production, he couldn't be ignored by the local government."
"What did he use that for?" Bobby asked. Nothing, Clarissa said with a delicate wave of one hand. But he had it. He owned an important piece of Ganymede, a thing he hadn't controlled before. And some men just need to own everything. Anything they lay their eyes on that they don't possess, it's like a sliver in their finger. Clarissa pushed her soggy fries away and smiled at them all. My father could be the kindest, most generous and loving man, right up until he wanted something and you wouldn't give it to him. I don't know why I think this, but Duarte feels the same. And these are men who will mercilessly punish anyone who won't comply, but with tears in their eyes and begging you to tell them why you made them do it.
I knew a few guys like that, Amos said. So, he won't stop until he has it all, Bobby said. And it looks like he has the tech to make it work. The armor, that destroyer, and that planet killer floating outside. All of this, they all look like they came out of the same factory to anyone else?
Yeah, it's protomolecule shit, Amos agreed. Some of it looks like the stuff growing on Eros.
I'm seeing a timeline here, Bobby said.
We were looking into those missing ships when I talked to this Duarte guy, Alex said. It was about the time Medina was throwing a lot of probes through the gates to get a gander at the usable planets.
Bobby finally got the ordering screen to come up on the table, but on impulse bought a glass of club soda instead of another beer. It felt like something important was on the tip of her mind, and she didn't want to drown it in booze. So, she said, letting the words come out the back of her head, hoping her subconscious had an insight it hadn't shared yet. A probe finds something in the Laconia system, something that makes ships and armor and who knows what else.
What, like a big volumetric printer that says insert protomolecule here on the side? Amos scoffed.
Hey, Alex replied. We found a planet-sized power generator with moons that could turn off fusion.
Amos considered that for a moment.
Yeah, fair enough.
Marco's people are running a fifth column on Medina by that point, Bobby continued. Duarte must have been working with them already. Said he'd slip them a fat payday for early info on the ring probes. They call him up and say, hey, we found this awesome thing.
He hands him a bunch of Martian ships, Alex said.
And Marco starts fucking up the solar system while Duarte takes the rest of his fleet and a bunch of like-minded Martians and takes over in Laconia. Bobby finished.
Where he spends a few decades making ships and fancy armor and whatnot, then rolls through the gate ready to name himself king,
Alex said as her club soda arrived. Which means Marco was just a tool, Bobby said.
Kinda knew that, Amos chimed in.
Free Navy kept everyone distracted while Duarte got set up on Laconia. And we've been sitting here patting ourselves on the back and trying to keep all the food supplies where they need to be for 30-odd years while he's been getting ready to kick the shit out of us, Bobby said.
Alex, maybe you should write up your thoughts on meeting him. What kind of guy he was?
I sat in his office for a few minutes. There are probably some people on Medina who served around the same time he did, Alex said. If we can find where the Martian vets hang out, we could see if anyone knew him.
Yeah, that's a good... Bobby started, then stopped when she noticed Amos stiffen in his chair.
The big mechanic's hand drifted toward his right hip and the gun that was no longer there since the Laconian weapon sweeps.
Amos, she said.
Trouble on the move,
he replied with a gentle tilt of his head. The people he'd nodded toward were a group of belters, old-school OPA by the tats. They were walking through the drum section nearby.
They wore coats too large and heavy for the constant perfect weather of Medina's drum section, and several carried large bags. They kept their heads down and moved fast, like people with a purpose. She recognized one of them. Oni Langstiever, the asshole head of security.
"What's over there?" Bobby asked.
"Some offices, the banking section, and some administrative stuff," Alex replied.
"The Laconians took it over," Clarissa added.
"Here we go," Amos said, and stood up. In the distance, the belters were pulling things out of their coats and bags. Bobby felt the surge of adrenaline in her blood the same moment as the calm descended on her. Danger followed immediately by the well-cultivated response to danger. It felt like being home. Bobby looked around the little bar for likely cover. Nothing within 10 steps looked like it would stop a bullet, so she grabbed Alex with one arm and Clarissa with the other and pulled them both to the ground with her. Amos was still standing up, watching the drama play out.
"Get down, you idiot!"
Clarissa started, but whatever else she was about to say was drowned out by the gunfire. Chapter 16. Sing. As he stepped out of the office complex, Sing made the mistake of looking up. The thin line of blazing full-spectrum light that ran down the center of Medina's habitat drum blinded him just a little. It cut a glowing streak across his vision and filled his eyes with tears. Like looking into a sun, if instead of an orb several light minutes away, it was a line drawn in the sky and very close.
"Hold on a moment," he said to his Marine escort as he tried to get his vision back.
"Copy that," the Marine replied, then said, "We're Oscar Mike, Trip Hammer 2 minutes from the cart, rolling teams for cover to station ops." It took Sing a moment to realize that most of that was calm chatter to his security detail. He had nothing but respect for the Marines under his command and for the security they provided, but they did love their jargon and code names. A moment later, he'd shaken most of the water out of his eyes, and the yellow-green afterimage line across his vision was fading.
"Okay, I'm ready."
"Copy that," the Marine replied, and pointed to a parking area about 50 meters away with 3 electric carts lined up and waiting. Lieutenant Kasich was hurrying toward him from the carts, waving a monitor that had been extended to its full size. He met them a few seconds later, puffing with exertion.
"I have the initial defense reports," Kasich said, handing the monitor to Sing.
"Excellent."
Sing scrolled past a spreadsheet of incomprehensible numbers.
"I hope there's a summary."
"Yes, sir. And the tech group is waiting for you in station ops to answer any questions. But the initial findings are very exciting."
"Tell me."
"What we can see," Kasich said, "is the ring system converted all of the energies from the Tempest's field projector into gamma rays released through the rings."
"We knew that," Sing replied with a frown.
"But the energy released was orders of magnitude more than the energy the central sphere absorbed. The ring system amplified it, exponentially. If the factor is consistent, we can create predictive models for input versus output very quickly." It was exactly what he'd hoped. The alien rings could be made into their own defenses, and the reconstruction of the defense batteries skipped entirely. The Tempest would be free to move into Sol's system months ahead of the original plan. Any attack would fail, even if it were coordinated through every ring at once. 1 Magnetar-class battlecruiser could guard 1,300 gates at once and never miss its shot. The battle to seize control of every human-controlled world in the galaxy was already over. After that, it was just administration of the new empire. Sing tried to imagine the High Council's pleasure
the possible rewards, and his imagination failed him. But one thing still bothered him. Why was it, Kasich, that we heard about this from a local? If this had gone overlooked, I'm sure we'd have found it, sir. But we weren't looking at the logs. We have additional data in operations, Kasich said, and I've requested technicians for more analysis. Singh realized his daydreaming of the High Consul's patronage had stretched into an awkward pause. Before he could reply, something shifted at the edge of his vision. Someone walking toward him with the purposeful stride of a messenger making a delivery. Except that the person striding toward him was Longstiever, the man who'd brought him the news of the new and glorious discovery. A small group of belters were following him. He assumed Longstiever was coming to demand a reward for his information. "I don't want," Singh began, but his marine guard had put one hand on his chest and shoved him back. Kasich nodded at him sharply one time, then spit berry-colored saliva all over his face. The marine yanked Singh to the ground hard, then knelt over him, shielding him with her body. Her knees pressed into his spine until it hurt. Singh heard her shouting orders, muffled by her helmet to the rest of the detail. And then he heard nothing but the deafening, ripping paper sound of multiple rapid-fire weapons opening up. His guard was sitting on top of him and blocking his view, but the space between her thigh and calf as she crouched created a small triangular window on the carnage. Longstiever and half a dozen other people were dancing backward as four Laconian marines cut them to pieces with streams of high-velocity plastic safety rounds. It felt like the firing went on forever, like the bullets were keeping the assassins from falling. In reality, it could only have lasted a few seconds. He experienced a little discontinuity in his consciousness, like he'd fallen briefly asleep, though that was impossible, and his marine had yanked him to his feet and was shoving him back toward the administrative offices. The other members of her fire team slowly backed toward them, weapons at the ready. Lieutenant Kasich still stood near the carts, not having moved during the entire firefight. He looked like he'd spit raspberry pie filling onto his lips, and he was twitching like an epileptic experiencing a grand mal. Singh understood something that had been eluding him. "Kasich's been shot," he said. The pie filling on his face was the ruins of his lips from where the bullet had exited. The spray of red on Singh's face and uniform wasn't spit. It was his aide's blood. "Medical has already been alerted," his marine said, thinking he was talking to her. "But no," Singh said. She didn't understand. "He's been shot." She shoved him through the admin building door and slammed it shut behind her. Just before it closed, the shocked silence that had followed the gunfire ended, and from 100 voices outside, the screaming started. Kasich died on an operating table 3 hours after the attack. According to the report, he'd been shot in the back of the head, the bullet fracturing the occipital lobe of his skull and nicking his medulla oblongata. It then passed through the back of his throat and nearly severed his tongue before shattering 5 teeth and exiting through his lips. Singh read the surgeon's section of the incident report 6 times. Each time felt like the first. None of the marine security detail had been harmed in the exchange of fire, though several civilians had received minor injuries from bullet fragments, and 1 boy of 9 had broken his arm while attempting to flee down a short flight of steps. All 7 of the Belter radicals who'd attempted the assassination were dead. The intelligence people were digging into their past associations to see if the rebellion had roots that spread farther. Rebellion. The word felt wrong to Singh. The most Longstiever and his accomplices could have hoped for was his death. It would have done nothing to hand control of the station back to the Belters who'd once run it. Trejo would simply have assigned another officer to fill his place until a new governor could be dispatched from Laconia. It was also short-sighted, so wasteful. 7 people had decided to toss their lives away on a symbol. "These are people who have a history of resisting centralized authority," Colonel Tanaka had said. He hadn't understood. He did now. They weren't rational. They weren't disciplined. They valued their own lives less than the prospect of his death. What struck him most, what offended him as much as the still implausible idea that he'd watched Kasich be murdered, was the monstrous ingratitude of it. The hubris of believing that Duarte's path for humanity's future was worth killing innocent people to resist. And after Trejo had been so generous with them. He tapped the monitor lying on his desk, and the comm officer in security replied with a crisp, "Yes, sir." "Please have Colonel Tanaka report to me in my office immediately." "Sir, yes, sir." Singh killed the connection almost before the officer finished speaking. He looked around his office, not to take in anything new so much as to judge his own mind. He wasn't feeling the shuddering in his hands anymore. His eyes were able to move from the door to his desk to the little ferns in their planters beside the wall without jittering back and forth of their own accord. He'd been in shock, only a little, and only for a short time. It was normal, natural, expected. The physiological effects were only the consequence of being an animal in a stressful situation. There was no reason for him to feel ashamed. And yet, when Tanaka entered the room with that little half-smirk on her lips, he had to rein his anger in. "Is this funny to you?" He didn't say it. "Sir," she said, bracing, "you wanted to see me." "I was almost murdered today," Singh said. "I found your silence on the matter disturbing." Tanaka's expression shifted. A little chagrin, maybe? It was hard to tell with her. Her voice didn't have the crispness he'd expect of someone being dressed down. "I apologize. After your safety was established, my focus was on the response and investigation. I should have reported in sooner." "Yes, well," Singh said. "Are you ready to make your report now?" Tanaka gathered her thoughts visibly, then nodded to the chair across the desk from his, silently asking his permission to sit. He waved a hand. She sat, leaning forward, her elbows resting on her knees. "The basic facts appear straightforward. The attempt was instigated and organized by Longstiever. He was the head of security before we came, and his co-conspirators were drawn from the ranks of the local security force." "Why weren't we monitoring them?" Singh asked. "We were. But it appears that Longstiever wasn't using the station network. My team is still digging into it, but it looks like he did his coordination and planning on an encrypted network set up in the power conduits, physically separate from the main system the way the storm is from Medina. Air-gapped. From what we can tell, it was put in by criminal elements in Medina Station. Longstiever also had relationships there." Singh leaned back a centimeter in his chair. "Criminal elements? You mean he was corrupt?" "It's not unusual on this side of the gate," Tanaka said, "and it makes the investigation more complicated than I'd like. Add to that, he appears to have purged several caches of data he still had access to and inserted false entries into what we have got. And Longstiever and his little friends aren't going to be questioned by anyone but God at this point." "But you found the network they were using." "One of them," Tanaka said. "There may be others. Part of the problem is that Medina wasn't run as a military installation. There were, and probably still will be, competing levels of culture and infrastructure. Controlling the official channels is trivial, but even the officials were using additional undocumented frameworks. It's not like the locals have to create ways to get around our surveillance. All those ways were built in before we showed up. She lifted her hands in a shrug. Singh had a stark flashbulb memory of Kasich, and with it a powerful, all-pervading dread. In his imagination, Nat and the monster were looking at a picture of him with blood spilling down his chin. It wasn't the prospect of his own death that brought the flush of rage. It was how cavalier Tanaka was being with them.
"Well, we'll have to address that directly, then," Singh said.
"Mandatory curfews and roaming checkpoints will be a start, and restrict the station security forces to quarters until they can be interrogated and evaluated for service. And I'll want a list of anyone who might pose a threat moving forward for precautionary monitoring. And, yes, and coordinate that through the gathering storm. If we can't be sure the local system's clean, we should use our own. The most important thing is that the systems on the gathering storm not be compromised."
"I've already set up an encryption strongroom," Tanaka said, nodding without seeming to agree. Her sigh was like grit on his skin.
"But you want to be careful about a crackdown, sir. Especially this early on. It could send the wrong message."
"The wrong message?" Singh repeated, stretching out each syllable into a question and a confrontation. "Belter culture and identity is built around pushing back against authority. This is what that looks like in practice. We knew something like this was possible, and..."
"We did?" Singh said, his voice sharp.
"We knew that, did we?"
Tanaka's eyes flattened and her lips thinned.
"Yes, sir, we did. It's why I had a fire team with you at all times, and, respectfully, it's why you're alive."
"Pity there wasn't one for Kasich."
"Yes, sir," Tanaka said. The languor in her tone was gone. She had the tightness in her voice that said that at last she was taking him seriously.
"I'm sorry to have lost him, but that doesn't change my assessment. Bringing Laconian focus and discipline to Medina Station and the other systems isn't a matter of imposing our customs and rules on them."
"I'm surprised to hear you say that."
"Our discipline is ours, sir. The same actions can have different meanings in different contexts. What would be routine back home would seem draconian here. Anything harsher than routine will read as a wild overreaction. I believe the High Council would agree that underreacting to this would be a more persuasive show of authority." Singh stood up. He hadn't meant to, but the need to move, to occupy the space inside his office, was suddenly overpowering. Tanaka stayed still. Her expression was like someone tracking a target on a firing range, focused but emotionless. He walked to his sideboard and poured himself a drink, since his aide wasn't there to do it for him.
"It's an interesting perspective, and I can respect it," Singh said. "But I don't share it. You have my instructions."
The alcohol was sharp and strangely acrid in his mouth. His gut rebelled a little at it. He swallowed anyway, trying to enjoy the bloom of warmth in his throat. Kasich had had a better hand at this than he did.
"Governor," Tanaka said, not standing. It was the first time he could remember her using the title.
"I strongly urge you to reconsider this. At least sleep on it before we implement it." He turned to look at her. He imagined himself as she saw him, a young man off Laconia for the first time as an adult, having been the target of enemy action for the first time, seeing an unplanned death by violence for the first time. He must seem shaken and weak to her, because as much as he hated the fact, he did feel shaken and weak, and naked before her implacable and judging gaze. She thought he was being irrational, letting his fear make his decisions. And if he changed his course now, it would prove her right. "Respectfully," Tanaka said, "as your head of security and a woman with a lot of years of experience in her bag, this isn't a set of orders I can support." Singh took in a long breath between bared teeth. His gums went cold with it. Whether he was right or wrong didn't matter now. He was committed. "Your second is Major Overstreet?"
"Yes, sir."
"Please send him in on your way out. You're relieved of your command." There it was in the flash of her eyes and the lift of her chin. The contempt he'd known would be there. Giving in to her would only have helped cultivate it. Tanaka had never respected him. She thought herself better suited to make the policies of governance than he was. It didn't matter whether she was right or not. She stood wordlessly, braced, and stalked out of the room. He more than half expected her to slam the door as she left, but she closed it gently. He finished his unpleasant drink in a gulp and went back to his desk. The alcohol did what it was supposed to do, taking his too sharp mind back just half a degree, letting him relax just a little bit. He wouldn't have another one. He pressed his palms flat against the surface of his desk, feeling the little bite of cool fading quickly. He took a deep breath, let it out slowly, then again. When his calm was more or less reestablished, he opened his personal log and reported his decision and the reasoning behind it. "Visible weakness to my chief of security undermines confidence in the chain of command. Tanaka's expertise is admirable, but her placement on Medina proved unsuitable. Recommend her without prejudice for more appropriate duty." Hopefully, his superiors would approve of his actions. If not, he'd know soon enough. It was done. Time that he got back to work. He felt better now, more centered, more nearly in control. It had been a bad day. Maybe the worst he'd ever suffered through. But he was alive, and his command was intact. And it was just a bad day. He opened a fresh message, flagged it for immediate delivery. For a moment, he felt the impulse was to send his first message home to Nat. To be with her, even if it was only a little bit. This attenuated, one-way presence would be better than nothing. But it would wait until he'd done his duty. Duty always came first. He routed the message for the Tempest, instead of home. "Admiral Trejo," he said into the system's camera, "I am including preliminary data provided by former Medina security chief Longstever and confirmed by my own staff." His own staff, meaning the dead man. Meaning his first sacrifice to the Empire. "Ah, yes. Confirmed by my own staff concerning an unexpected side effect of our actions while securing Medina Station. If Command agrees with my assessment that this windfall provides a significant defense and is willing to position a ship equipped with a USM field projector permanently to the ring space, it is my belief that the timetable for further occupation can be moved up considerably. If the Tempest adopts a more aggressive schedule, the local forces in Sul's system will have a considerably reduced period to prepare defenses. We can have absolute control of Earth and Mars in weeks." Chapter 17. Holden.
"Stay still," the Laconian said. "Look at the red dot."
Holden blinked and did as he was told. The sack of rations tapped against his leg like it was trying to get his attention, but he didn't shift his weight.
The dot on the hand terminal seemed to look back at him, and something flashed, filling one eye with yellow. The guard's hand terminal chimed, and he shifted to Naomi. His other hand was on the butt of his gun.
Stay still. Look at the red dot. You can move along, sir.
I'm with her.
You can move over there, sir,
the guard said, gesturing down the corridor with his chin. His voice didn't make it a request. Holden walked a few steps, then paused while he was still close enough to go back if something happened. Not that he knew what he'd do. The hand terminal chimed again, and the guard nodded Naomi forward, waiting until she was back with Holden, and the two of them were moving down the gently curving hall of the crew decks, before he turned back to the line and the next identity to check and record. An older man, with a close-cropped beard, who was smiling at the guard like a dog hoping it wouldn't get kicked.
Stay still, the guard said. Look at the red dot.
And then Holden and Naomi turned the corner and left the checkpoint behind. He felt his gut release a little. The tension backed off a notch just by not being in a direct line of fire.
Well, this sucks, he said.
The security announcement had changed Medina like dye dropped into water. The rolling curfew meant no one in public spaces off shift, and 3 one-hour periods each cycle when no one could be out of their quarters. A congregation ban, no more than 3 people in a group. Anyone with a weapon would be arrested. Anyone making unauthorized use of the comm system would be arrested. Anyone that the security forces deemed a threat would be arrested. With every new edict, the nature of the station itself shifted, and the fragile thought that maybe everything would work itself out, that maybe it would be all right, receded. He knew the station architecture hadn't really changed. The walls were still at the same angles as before, the hallways curved around the drum the same as they ever had. The air smelled the way air smelled anywhere. It was only the faces of the people that made everything seem smaller, closer, more like a prison. The faces and the checkpoints. They reached their rented quarters, and Naomi tapped in the manual override code since their hand terminals were still locked out. The door slid open. When it slid closed behind them, Naomi sagged against it like she was on the edge of collapse. Holden sat at the little built-in table and unpacked the bag in silence. Pad Thai and red curry, both with tofu and both spiced enough to make his eyes water a little bit just at the smell of them. On another day, it would have felt like a luxury. Naomi went to the bath, washed her face in the little sink, and came back out with droplets of water still clinging to her hair and eyelashes. She dropped down across from him and scooped up a fork.
Any thoughts? She asked. About?
She waved the fork in a small circle, indicating the room, the station, the universe. Then she speared a cube of tofu and popped it in her mouth.
Not yet, he said. I've got to say, I wish that those assholes hadn't tried to kill this thing fella.
Or that they'd done a better job, Naomi said, and Holden felt a twitch of anxiety in his gut. Was the station security monitoring their cabin? Was that kind of offhanded joke going to get them sent to the brig? Naomi saw it in his face.
Sorry, she said.
Half for him, and half for the microphone that might or might not have been there. Bad joke.
I'm thinking this takes the Luna consulting gigs off the table, though.
Seems like it. And Titan.
That's a shame. I would have liked Titan.
If only we'd gotten out a week earlier, Naomi said. Things were different then.
Yeah, Holden said.
The pad thai was rich and hot, and it tasted almost like they'd used real limes and peanuts to make it.
Almost, but not quite.
He put his fork down.
I don't know what to do.
Eat, Naomi said. And when you're done with that, come take a shower with me. Seriously? He said. She hoisted an eyebrow and smiled. They ate in silence after that. He thought about putting on some background music and even reached for his hand terminal before he remembered that it was dead. After, Naomi put the plates and forks into the recycler and led him into the bathroom by the wrist. She pulled off her clothes slowly, and he felt himself responding to her body despite the stress and fear. Or maybe because of it. Lust and anxiety mixed into something that was more than one kind of desperation. She got the water to a decent temperature while he stripped, and then they were there together. Arms around each other as the warm cascade filled the curves where their bodies made cups and reservoirs. She leaned her head against his, her lips beside his ear. "We can talk now," she murmured. "We've got about 15 minutes before the rationing kicks in." "Oh," he said, "and here I thought this was just my masculine charm." She grabbed him gently, someplace sensitive. "That too," she said, and the laughter in her voice was better than anything that had happened in days. "We need to make a real plan. I don't know what's going to happen with our money. We only have this room to the end of the week, and I'm not sure whether we'll keep it past that, or if they'll throw us out early. Or anything else, really. Not at this point." "We've got to get back to the Rossi," he said. "Maybe," Naomi said. "Unless that calls more attention to the kids. It might not be a kindness to have James Holden of the Rosinante ride again. Unless that's a fight you want to be a part of." "You think there's going to be a fight?" She shifted against him, their skin slipping distractingly under the flow of water. "What would Avasarala say?" Naomi asked. Holden moved his arms around the small of her back, pulled her gently against him, kissed her gently. "That Governor Singh fucked up," he said softly. "The cracking down on the enemy this hard shows that you're afraid of them." "Yup," Naomi said. "The people who went after him? They were assholes and amateurs. There's a real underground going to start now, and it's going to have the professionals. If you and I keep our noses very, very clean, we might be able to stay out of that. If we start reaching out to the crew, security may think we're putting the band back together." "So, leave them out of it? Commit fully to our new lives as war refugees? Or suck it up, get the band back together, and die as dissidents?" "I'm really wishing Titan were still on that list of options." "That's waiting for yesterday, sweetheart." He rested his head against her shoulder. The water ration warning cleared its throat. Just the first one, though. They still had time. "Why do I get the feeling I'm more freaked out about this than you are?" he asked, and felt her smile against his cheek. "You're new here," she said. "I'm a belter. Security coming down on you just because they can. Checkpoints and identity tracking. Knowing that you could wind up in the recycler for any reason or no reason. I grew up like this. Amos did too, in his way. I never wanted to come back here, but I know how this all goes. Childhood memories, Sasaki." "Well, shit." She ran her hand down his spine and pushed him back. The wall was cold against him. Her kiss was rough and strong, and he found himself pushing into it in a way he hadn't in years. When they came up for air, Naomi's eyes were hard, almost angry. "If we do this," she said, "it's going to be ugly. We're outgunned and outplanned, and I don't see how we win." "I don't either," he said, "and I don't see how we stay out of it." "Getting the band back together?" "Yeah. And we were so close to out." "We were," she said.
The water ration chimed again, a little more urgently. Holden felt some vast emotion move in his chest, but he didn't know what it was. Grief, or anger, or something else. He turned off the water. The rush of white noise stopped. The gentle chill of evaporation brought goosebumps up on his arms and legs. Naomi's eyes were soft, dark, unflinching.
"Come to bed," he said.
"Yes," she answered. In the darkness, the control pad on the door glowed amber. Green would have meant unlocked, red, locked. Amber meant override. It meant that they weren't in control of it. That, in a fundamental way, it wasn't their door anymore. It belonged to station security. Naomi was still asleep, her breath deep and regular, so Holden sat in the darkness, not moving to keep from waking her, and watched the amber light. It was the dead hour of curfew between each shift. Right now, all the hallways in Medina were empty. The curved fields and parks of the drum, the lifts in lockdown. Only the Laconian security forces could travel freely while everyone else huddled in place, including him. Measured in work hours, it was a massive tax. If it had just been the Rossi, it was the same as losing someone for 18 hours a day. Medina put a coefficient on that with at least 3 zeros at the end. Someone in the Laconian chain of command thought it was worth the sacrifice. That alone told him something. Naomi murmured, shifted her pillow, and fell back into it without ever quite breaching up into consciousness. She would be awake soon, though. They'd been sleeping in the same couch long enough that he knew the signs her body gave out without even being certain what he was reacting to. He felt it when she was heading back up. He hoped she could stay down until it was their door again. Maybe she wouldn't feel the same kind of trapped that he did. Over the years, the Rossi had done its fair share of prisoner transport duty. Houston had been the most recent. But they'd taken on half a dozen like him one time and another since the Tachi had become the Rosinante. Now that he thought about it, the first had been Clarissa Mao. All of his prisoners had spent months in a cabin smaller than this, staring at a door they couldn't control. He'd always known in a distant, intellectual way that that had probably been uncomfortable for them, but it wouldn't have been that different from being in a brig, and he'd been in brigs. It wasn't the same, though. A brig had rules. It had expectations. You were in a brig until your lawyer or union rep came to talk to you. There would be hearings. If it went badly, there was prison. One thing followed another, and everyone called it justice, even when they all knew it was an approximation at best. But this was a cabin, a living space. Turning it into a prison cell felt like a rupture in a way that an actual prison cell wouldn't. A brig had an inside and an outside. You were in it, and then you passed through a door or a security lock, and you were out of it. All of Medina was a prison now, and would be for another 12 minutes. It left him feeling claustrophobic and depressed in a way he was still trying to wrap his head around. He felt like the station had just become small as a coffin. Naomi shifted again, pulling the pillow over her head. She sighed. Her eyes stayed closed, but she was with him again, awake but not ready to admit it.
"Hey,"
he said, softly enough that she could pretend not to have heard him.
"Hey,"
she said. Another minute passed, and Naomi pulled the pillow back under her head, yawned and stretched like a cat. Her hand landed on his, and he laced his fingers between hers.
"Been brooding the whole time?"
she asked.
"Some of it, yeah."
"Did it help?"
"Nope."
"Right." Spring into action, then?
He nodded at the amber door alarm. Not yet.
She glanced down. The override light flickered in her eyes like a candle flame.
Huh. All right.
Brush teeth, pee, and spring into action?
That'll work, he agreed, and hauled himself up out of the bed.
The way it worked out, he was brushing his teeth when the door clicked over to red, locked but under his control. The relief and resentment at the relief came packaged together. The hallways in the residential deck were no busier than usual. The checkpoint they'd passed through earlier was gone, relocated to some other intersection of hallways. Keeping the surveillance unpredictable and visible, he assumed. If the security systems were in Laconian control, the guards and checkpoints were all theater anyway. A show of force to keep the locals scared and in line. The transport was down. No lifts, no carts. If anyone wanted to go anywhere, the only option was to walk. In the drum, the false sunlight was as warm as ever. The fields and parkland, streets and structures, curved up and around the same way they always had. Holden could almost forget that it was an occupied station until they interacted with anyone. The man they paused to get bowls of noodles and sauce from gave them extra packets of peanuts and a twist of cinnamon sugar candy on the house. An older woman they walked past as they headed aft toward engineering and the docks smiled at them, then stopped and stroked Naomi's shoulder until little tears appeared in the older woman's eyes. A group of young men headed the other way, made room for them to pass long before they needed to, and nodded their respect. It wasn't, Holden decided, that people recognized him and deferred to his celebrity. All the citizens of Medina were treating each other like everyone was made from spun sugar, likely to shatter if you breathed on them too hard. He recognized it from being on Luna after the rocks had fallen on Earth. The deep human instinct to come together in crisis, to take care of each other. In its best light, it was what made humanity human. But he also had the dark suspicion that it was a kind of bargaining. Look, universe, see how gentle and kind and nice I am? Don't let the hammer fall on me. Even if it was only grief and fear, he'd take it. Anything that helped them all treat each other well. Beside a little cafe that served tea and rice flour cakes, a dozen people in Laconian uniforms were building something. A wall made of cubes 2.5 meters to a side, 8 wide and 3 high, with steel walls and backs and wide mesh doors facing the pathway. Like kennels. Half a dozen locals stood watching, and Naomi went to stand beside them. A young woman with mud-brown hair and a scattering of freckles across her cheeks made a little space for them. Another small kindness, like a coin in a wishing well. "Are they expecting prisoners, then?" Naomi asked the woman as if they were friends, as if everyone who wasn't Laconian was part of the same group now.
"That's the thought," Freckles said. Then nodded a greeting to Holden.
"Making a show of it. Supposed to keep us all in line, isn't it?"
"That's how it works," Holden said, trying to keep the bitterness out of his voice. "Show everyone what the punishment is. Enough fear, and we'll all be obedient. They'll train us like dogs."
"That's not how you train dogs," Freckles said. She made a little deferential bow when he looked at her, but she didn't back down. "You train dogs by rewarding them. Punishment doesn't actually work."
Tears glistened in her eyes, and Holden felt a lump in his own throat.
They'd been invaded. They'd been taken over. They could kill everyone on the station, and no one would be able to stop it. This couldn't be happening. And it was happening.
"I didn't know that," he said. Banal words, the closest he could offer to comfort.
Punishment never works, Naomi said, her voice hard. Her face was unreadable. She shifted her weight like she was looking at sculpture in a museum. The spectacle of power considered as art. Not ever.